This is episode 447 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Chris Bruce and Brandon Turkus, and we talk about the 2016 Honda Civic. We wrap up the 2016 Frankfurt Motor Show coverage and other news and notes. That's all ahead on episode 447 of the Autoblog Podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Chris Bruce.
Good evening, everyone.
And Brandon Turkus.
Hello, hello, hello.
Brandon has been up for like 96 hours straight, so we're going to try to take it easy on him.
Yeah, you're going to get to hear all sorts of fun things from me tonight.
All right, we'll get through it. So
it would be even more unhinged than usual.
Excellent. Sweet. It's going to make for great podcast listening. The first thing we do is the garage, and since we're trying to take it easy on you, you can go first and tell us what you're driving.
Yeah, I am driving the wonderful Fiat 500 Abarth.
Car with no muffler.
Car with no muffler. All cars should have no muffler.
many will if you wait long enough.
Well, this is a pretty basic Abarth. I don't actually have Monroney. I should probably just go and build one real quick. But you got the 5-speed manual. Heated seats, no navigation, no sunroof. It does have the really, really nice upgraded wheels. I want to say they're actually 16s, but they look better than the 17s.
So that, and it's got the hilarious Fiat 500 driving position still, regardless of whatever seats.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's still got that obnoxious, you know, driving position. You have to stomp down on the clutch and all that stuff. But it's still, this car is just, it's one of those vehicles that no matter how it's equipped, you just want to drive it like an absolute boob. Like, you want to go everywhere, bouncing off the red line, slicing through traffic. There's just something about it. It's just a riot.
You and I have talked about the Abarth before, and you've always really loved it. Is it aging well as, you know, other hot hatches kind of enter?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. It's probably the worst hot hatch you can buy aside from like a Monster Turbo.
Right. So you picked you definitely picked one that was worse.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that the Abarth is bad. It's just that the competition is much, much better.
But the Abarth has got charm that nobody else has because.
Oh, yeah. It's far more fun, and Steve's going to hate me for saying this, but it's a lot more fun than a GTI in, like, everyday driving, I think. Because the GTI is so powerful that you kind of have to restrain yourself at times. And it doesn't have, you know, it's a very agile car, but it doesn't quite have the same sort of terrier-like, you know, driving character as the Abarth does. And because you're only playing with, like, 160 horsepower, you can, you know, drive it as hard as you want, and you're not really going to get into too much trouble with it.
Yeah. So if you're buying with your head, you'd go with the Fiesta ST, but if you're buying with your heart, you go with the Abarth.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think that performance-wise and just overall package, the Fiesta ST wins.
The thing is that Seth and I were talking about this today at lunch. I would never, ever, ever buy a new 500 Abarth because you're going to wake up the next day and half your value is going to be gone. Mm-hmm. But I would turn around and like buy one of the, like a 2 or 3 year old example, like a CPO car in a heartbeat. Cause I think it's just a tremendous bargain for that kind of driving fun.
It is definitely fun and it has a charm to it. The Fiesta ST, I feel like is a more finished overall rounded package. It is less.
Totally. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing with the GTI. I mean, aside from like, and this is kind of a bold statement, but in terms of these ultra affordable, you know, hot hatchbacks, I just knocked stuff over on my table next to me.
He's flailing, folks. He's flailing.
Yeah. Aside from, and like I said, this is going to be a bold statement, but aside from my Mini, like an R53 Cooper S, like I'm really hard-pressed to think of a car that's this, you know, that is just this darn thrilling.
Well, and for the price.
You could make for the price. And you could make an argument for the MX-5, and you could make one for the Fiesta ST, and you could make one for the GTI, and even the current Cooper S. But I think this the Abarth has just a character that none of those cars can really match.
Well, I think the Mini is probably the one that comes closest in terms of what it offers. It offers that style that harks back to a pretty historic model, and it's still, you know, legitimately capable. The Abarth does that for a price point that's at least $10,000 cheaper. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, it's doesn't seem to have achieved the same kind of cachet. And I don't know that cachet is really what you look for when you're driving a Fiat, regardless. But, like, do you feel any sense of embarrassment driving this anywhere, showing up in it?
Hell no. I mean, I don't feel any sense at all because you hear the thing before you see it.
It does sound good. Oh, I like the way it sounds.
Just talking about price real quick, I just built, like, my ideal 500 Barth on the Fiat website, and it's $22,495. Well, actually, sorry. It's $23,875, but then there's $2,000 off right now for leases.
So that sits it right at $20,000.
It's, yeah, just over $21,000. Which, I mean, again, you don't want to buy one of these brand new, but if the brand new ones are going for $21,000 and it's, you know, I've got the Beats stereo and I've got the, you know, the heated seats and all that stuff, and the new models of these are going for $21,000. A used one is just an awesome little deal.
I have nothing more to add to that.
Yeah, I can't fight that.
Can't argue with you. You're making sense tonight. You must be tired.
I keep on telling my girlfriend that one of these days I'm just going to go to the local Fiat dealership and with my Mini and come home with, like, a used Abarth.
I mean, that's not something you can't support. That's okay.
One unreliable car for another unreliable car that comes with, like, a CPO warranty. I could trade it in. I'd be financing roughly the same amount of money. So,
but you're trading a turbo or a supercharger for a turbo. That would be hard because
the supercharger is just, it's basically you're comparing that supercharger whine with, like, a car with no muffler.
They both are
a treat to the ears.
The Abarth sounds great.
And remarkably, a Cooper S with no muffler doesn't sound very good. So it definitely doesn't sound as good as the Abarth.
Huh. Well, you've given us food for thought.
What are you driving, sir?
So I had an interesting lesson in contrast this week. I started off with a Ford Edge Sport, which is very nice. It looks great. They've done a really good job of restyling the Edge for its now third generation. It's second generation, but it had that first generation, which was like a mid-cycle refresh, and going way too far down the rabbit hole, obviously. But it looks fantastic this time around. And the Sport is dressed up to be the most sort of aggressive and sportiest, hence the name, looking with giant wheels and just nice detailing. The interior is really nice. It's comfortable. It's a very comprehensive update, and it's very well done. It's pricey. This one stickered out at $46,680, and then they took $500 off for the all-wheel drive. So it wound up being, you know, $46,180. That's a lot of dough for an Edge. And overall, it did not. It's one of those cars where they put sport in the name, but it's a lie because it didn't feel sporty in any way. And it was surprising to get the next vehicle because it really pointed out that contrast. Right now, I'm driving a Honda Pilot all-wheel drive Elite, a 2016. That's brilliant, and it's not really an apples to apples comparison. Obviously the Pilot's a little bigger and it has three rows, but sure. The Pilot feels really light on its feet. The steering is actually, it communicates what's going on with the tires. It rides nice. It's quiet. It's probably not as quiet as the Edge. It's got that new V6 from Honda and the 9-speed automatic, and it does its thing, and it does it quite well. The Edge was carrying the 2.7 liter EcoBoost, which have you guys noticed the small EcoBoost? And I can't really remember if the 3.5 does it too, but it's a funny sounding engine.
You know, I'm ashamed to say it, but I have not driven the 2.7 liter EcoBoost.
Well, yeah, why slum it?
Well, I mean, I haven't driven the new F-150, and when I did the launch of the Edge earlier this year, and because Ford doesn't know how to plan a program out, I got about, you know, 2 hours to drive the regular model and no time at all on the Sport. So you're in kind of foreign territory on that.
Well, so what did you think of the regular model?
I thought the regular model was fine. I think, you know, the Edge is very much a lifestyle vehicle, and it sounds weird because it's a five person crossover, but this isn't, you know, necessarily the vehicle that's being bought by people that are starting a family or something like that, or have like a big family. It's bought by, you know, the empty nesting crowd and whatnot.
Certainly it's in like the family vehicle contention, but like as a lifestyle vehicle, it helps if your lifestyle doesn't include lots of large things. Because it's, sure. You know, it's just like the Taurus in that sense, right? It takes up pretty decent amount of room on the outside, and
but there's not that much space inside.
Yeah, and it's, you know,
I didn't feel it was especially cramped, but I mean, it's not, you know, that really aggressive rear window certainly doesn't help,
right?
You know, cargo volume or anything like that. Right.
It's competitive in all of the ways it needs to be. You know, it's easy to get in. It's comfortable. You know, the step in height is lower than other sort of pseudo SUV crossovers. It's a sedan alternative, and it's not meant to be anything other than that. And it does really well at what it does. You know, I was impressed with the way Ford's upgraded the interior, because I remember the first time I drove an Edge, and it just had this nasty, like, unpadded, disgusting plastic door panels and stuff. And you're like, whoa, it looks good from 10 feet away, but yikes. It's very nice. And you know, again, the Sport, so it's all dressed up. You know, it had my Ford Touch too, which makes me stabby still. Like the last time I had my Ford Touch, it was in, I think it was in an F-150, and I kind of gave it a little bit of a pass, where it felt not quite as bad, and I was sort of a little bit more charitable to it. This time around on the Edge, it's slow and laggy and very frustrating to use. So,
and you recently tried Sync 3 as well, right? So going back to my Ford Touch, is it kind of hellish? Yeah.
It's not really hellish.
Even though it's Sync 3?
Sync 3 is much, much better. Much better.
Okay, I was going to say, yeah, I didn't think that had it.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
Right, but I know you've used Sync 3 in the past month or so, so I was just wondering. Yeah.
Well, and so the Honda, too. The Honda has their new Android-based system that's in the Pilot that's actually a big improvement over what Honda had been foisting on us before.
It's still not great, though.
It's not great, but it's much more responsive, and it works well when you can figure out where what you want actually is. it's still like got tons of functions that are buried deep, but it's getting better. Honda's working on it, which, you know, brings me to I think probably our first topic is the Honda Civic that we saw, because I think that's probably the most important thing that we've seen this week, other than the stuff in Germany, which we've kind of covered for the last 2 weeks. So, Brandon, one of the reasons why you're so exhausted is you actually went to the reveal of the Honda Civic, and the embargo lifted like 45 minutes ago. So,
yep, 45 minutes ago. First, if you're looking at the story online, I want to apologize for the live images. The lighting was absolutely atrocious.
I think you could probably figure out a way to write off or expense a fancy, fancy camera that can do stuff in real life.
Even with a flash, I had like professional photographers that were like, this is just terrible. Like guys that I know that, you know, shoot really well, like we're having trouble with it. So it was just, you know, Honda chose a location that, was cool, but not necessarily conducive to photography. But that's neither here nor there. Saw the new Civic, saw it in person. It's a very handsome car.
Well, yeah, I mean, we all saw it in person when it leaked. Honda must have been pissed about that.
Yeah, I mean, somehow I don't think they weren't as pissed about it as I thought they would be.
So can I ask a question?
I was talking to some of the PR people.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think it was actually an accident? Because
that's the thing.
Ann Arbor, where there are too many auto journalists, there are too many magazines, there's too much stuff there. If it was found in Marysville, you know, Ohio or something like that, I could believe it.
But why would you leak it?
So unbelievable.
Why would you leak it when you had the reveal coming up?
It wasn't. I don't think it was necessarily Honda. I think they you know, on the DL loaned it out to somebody, and they just either weren't careful or were told not to be careful.
I've never been told not to be careful.
I mean,
you go off and be reckless.
But to answer your question,
maybe that's not the best way.
It's a early buzz. Sorry for talking over you.
No. I mean, I don't think it was so much that they were told not to be careful. I think it was kind of like, oh no, you're leaking our car. Oh no, oh no. And I don't think they really cared as much as they would have cared in another circumstance.
Well, and I guess in terms of being a PR person's nightmare, if we're going to want to get inside baseball, like, it's not that big a deal because it got quickly swallowed up by Frankfurt. So
exactly. And, you know, and here's the thing about it that makes me like really kind of just feel weird about it. Why are there only three pictures? Like, if you're a Honda enthusiast that as part of a Honda Civic forum and you see the new car on the street a week before it debuts, why aren't you out there like climbing all over it, taking pictures of everything? I never thought of
that. That's a great point. Yeah. Why didn't you cross the street and take photos of the interior and stuff?
Exactly. It's one of those things. It's weird. You know, I don't want to focus too much on that because
it makes it sound like we have tinfoil in our hats. And
there is.
I
was going to say we very well may, but we shouldn't about that. So what did you think of it when you actually got to see it up close? I mean, so the we've all seen the styling and we can talk about how we feel about that. But the issues with the Civic were the hard interior, the terrible tech. It was always a pretty good car at its core, but everybody else sort of got much more deluxe and has it gotten better?
Honda really got caught flat-footed because they designed this car, you know, because everyone knows it, designing a brand new car is not an overnight process. You know, Honda got caught flat-footed and designed a car for a world that didn't pan out the way they thought it was going to. And, you know, the last-gen Civic, and I wrote about this, last-generation Civic came out at exactly the wrong time as the public was embracing, you know, more premium features and an emphasis on design.
Well, and so the last generation Civic 2 was like the update of the 2005, which was a really hard act to follow because that car was like a
spaceship. It was a very good car.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very good car. And, you know, they didn't quite take it far enough with the ninth generation model, which, you know, it was funny. They showed us a graphic during the presentation today, and it tracked like all 10 generations of the Civic. And you're seeing like these long model years, long, you know, 2005 to 2012 for the eighth generation, and like 97 or 96 to like 2005 for the seventh generation.
Oh, that's right.
whatever it was. Yeah. And then you'd see ninth generation, 2012 to 2015.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of an interesting graphic.
And Honda of all companies does not generally do that.
Right. Yeah. It was, you know, I think they definitely got caught flat footed. I think they gambled wrong. Is what it really came down to with it.
So that's been largely corrected?
Yeah. I mean, the model that they had on display, I'm trying to remember what trim level. I feel like it was a top-end trim level.
It looks like it was – I'm looking at the trunk now. It looks like the badge is like touring or something or
whatever. Yeah, I think it was a touring or limited or whatever their top-end trim level is. But as you can see, I mean, there's – a lot of tech in here. You have that awesome TFT display in the center, which is, you know, it's a really nice touch. It integrates the tachometer and the speedometer, and I'm willing to bet there will be some trip functions in there that I wasn't able to play with. But it looks really good in person. It has the same Android-based infotainment system that you like so much in the Pilot, Dan.
Yeah, it's pretty good in the Pilot, especially considering where Honda has come from.
Right. It's a 7-inch touchscreen. I don't like that it still has the really crummy touch buttons on the side.
Yeah, that's complete lack of features. Oh, and it shows every single fingerprint.
Right. But the interior is nice. They lower the H point on the driver's seat by about an inch. And you get in it and you feel like you're sitting much lower than you actually are. And I may have misheard them, so that's why I didn't put this in there. But during the presentation, while I was running around trying to, you know, get pictures before the scrum, I thought I heard them say something that they aimed for an H point that was equal to an Audi TT. Which is, if I heard that correctly, is super, super ambitious for a compact sedan.
But does that make it feel like you're sitting in a hole?
It doesn't make it feel like you're sitting in a hole. And again, I only sat in it for a couple minutes, like snapshots, because
there were
40 other journalists. Right. This was basically like almost auto show atmosphere. Right,
this is kind of like
scrums.
Meet the car, take some pictures, and then in a few weeks we'll have one to drive.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to be driving it in a couple of weeks. Seth's going to be driving it. So, sorry, my dog is sniffing.
No, that's all right.
I don't know what he's doing.
I would love to tee off sort of the styling discussion. And Chris, you've been patiently waiting to let us know exactly what you think about it. So,
it looks fantastic. Like, I've seen some of our commenters and stuff kind of debate, you know, maybe the trunk opening's too small, maybe this or that, but it looks great.
You don't think it looks too much like a Maxima?
No, I don't.
Looks Nissan-y to me.
Maybe. No, I honestly, I think it looks fantastic. I can't wait to actually see it in person and get an idea of kind of the dimensions of it and see it in context.
It's very average for the class in terms of size. I think it might be, and this is just, you know, eyeballing it on my part, I think it's a little bit smaller than a Focus sedan, but not substantially so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The thing that really strikes
bigger
you about
than
it.
Pictures.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that in person. And again, I've not looked at any measurements. This is completely just eyeballing it on my part. But the thing that really struck me about it is that front wheel arch, the way it kind of curves over smoothly is, when you look at it in the profile, it's very Mazda 3. And I wrote this in the leak shots. It's not a bad thing. It's a good look. But if you look at the car from the side, it looks a hell of a lot like a Mazda.
Well, it's got a little bit more Christmas to it. You know, there's only so many things you can do with four wheels and three boxes. So,
true. That's the thing. Even this isn't necessarily, you know, a typical three box.
Yeah, it's got more of a fastback profile.
It's a very fastback profile. And I didn't include it in the gallery because it wasn't a great shot without context. But if you look at that rear window, it's actually sunk down just a little bit.
The rear glass.
Yeah. So the C pillars come down, and they're actually probably about an inch above the glass.
Wonder if that's an airflow management thing.
That's what I'm thinking, because you can see it kind of, that trend kind of carries down, like feeds into the deck lid.
Yeah.
If you're looking at like the rear three quarters right now, and it's just a really nice little styling detail, and I'm willing to bet there's, you know, something practical to it, but it looks cool.
Well, I mean, I will say that it's much more expressive than the Civic has been in a while. It's Honda has, you know, with the HR-V as well, they've found some styling mojo that they're putting back into their cars. And, you know, we focus so much on the looks of this right now because we haven't had a chance to really get any information about the engines or drive it. So basically we've gone and we've seen it, we've sat in it. And, you know, the driving impressions are really going to be what either sets the Civic apart or sinks it. I mean, the competition has gotten tough. And the Civic has always been a really great competitor in that space. So, I mean, do you think it still has a chance? I mean, just sort of looking it over, does it have what it takes?
I mean, yeah, I think it's got an uphill battle, and it really, you know, it's hard to make a determination though with so little on the specs. You know, basically we know what kind of engines it will have. We know it will have a CVT. We don't really know anything about it beyond that, though. You know, so it's really dependent on what Honda can squeeze out of the 2 liter and the 1.5 turbo. And I think you're going to see that. I think the make or break for this thing, and Honda's had a problem with this with their four cylinders. I feel like they just don't quite have the same punch that you get in a small turbocharged engine from another automaker.
They still feel like Honda engines. They rev a lot and they're smooth.
They rev a lot and they're smooth. But in terms of like actual motion, I mean, I haven't really been blown out of the water by any of them.
I'm just going to hold my breath for the SI and see what they do with it.
This is a new engine family too, though, so this could change. Or at least I'm pretty sure it's a new, you know, fairly new engine family.
I think it is. I will say I'm extremely intrigued by the 1.5 turbo.
Yeah, turbos are not common in Hondas, so that's
no. This is the first turbo that Honda sold in the United States, which is kind of astonishing. Considering how long Honda's been around, I'm kind of surprised there wasn't like a early turbocharged Civic Si or something like that in like the 80s, but there's nothing like that. So it's kind of a big deal for them. Like, this is the engine that's going to be, you know, proof of concept for future Honda turbos, I think. At least here in the U.S.
As much as I, you know, am on the fence about the styling, I'm a general believer in Honda's philosophy and the way they really thoughtfully put cars out. And they're still, you know, they're a big player in the market, but they're a small independent automaker, really, when you get down to it. So I tend to be, very enthusiastic about what they're doing. So I really want to see the Civic up close, and hopefully it looks as promising from in person as it does on the spec sheet. So I guess we'll have to wait. And the SI, that's going to be the real excitement when that drops. And again, that's like another super competitive field now, where you've got the GTI and the variants of the Focus, and just there's competition up there where there wasn't before. So are you guys going to miss the naturally aspirated engines that rev, though? It seems like everybody's going to turbos.
Here's the thing, you know, you look at those engines, and the last really good naturally aspirated revy, you know, VTEC four cylinder that Honda made was like the 8th generation Civic Si. When the 9th generation came along, they screwed it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know,
I see what you're saying, Dan. In general, it seems like, you know, naturally aspirated engines are going by the wayside, at least in terms of performance cars. It's, you know, it's nice. It's fun to rev something that sounds.
It is.
And it's a lot of fun. But I can see it both ways, though. The alternative is that, you know, that kind of rush of boost. That's kind of intoxicating, too.
It is, but it's so weird. Like, when you get into something that doesn't have that springy power delivery, you're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, this one's just, it's a free breather. You know, it's like, and it's going away. Like, everything has turbos now. You know, the Edge had a turbo, and that's another difference between the Edge and the Pilot. So it's just, you know, turbos are you know, in the widest use they've been since the 80s. I think they're probably actually in more stuff now. So I wonder where that trend leads. But
I had a question for you, Brandon, real quick. So sure. The 2 liter and the 1.5 turbo have different CVTs. Did they say anything at all?
They specifically say in the press release, two CVTs.
Right. They say the 1.5 is mated to a unique CVT. And I'm just curious, you know, what's prompting that decision?
Again, that's the thing that's gonna be discussed at the launch, I think. I think we'll find out all about that when we finally drive it.
It may be as simple as the actual ratio spread.
Sure, right.
You know, for a smaller engine, different and you know, just like a different shift logic and that kind of stuff. It seems weird that they'd need to make two different CVTs, but if the 1.5 liter is, you know, has more low end torque because it's turbocharged, then the CVT is going to have to be able to handle that. So I'm sure they'll tell us. We can ask.
Sure.
You know, that's a very good question to dig into.
Also, from the day I heard about this 1.5 turbo, I've been wanting them to put it in the Fit and make a Fit SI.
Oh, that would be awesome.
I've wanted a Fit SI for as long as I can remember.
Would you call it the Fitzy?
I would call it the Fitzy.
Get a green one, make it Irish. So let's pick up, though, from the, we've talked about the Civic for quite a bit, but it was a great entry to sort of the auto show thing that, you know, Frankfurt is wrapping up. And, you know, we've talked about that for the last couple of weeks. So, I mean, maybe we should just wrap it up with our, I don't know, let's, why don't you pick like the top three, each of you guys, that your top three from.
Oh, man.
I'll start.
I was going to say, go first. Let Brandon think.
Okay. I think in terms of importance, the Mission E, the Porsche Mission E concept is really, really vital. Just the fact that they're... I don't know if you guys have seen the trailers for Star Wars, the new Force Unleashed movie.
No, I've been avoiding.
New Stormtrooper helmets. It looks like you put one of those in an oven and left it for like 2 hours to me.
Yeah, not, I can see that.
I'm not loving, well, especially at the front end. The profile's okay, but the front end styling.
It does look kind of melted.
Do you think that that's this generation's 959 right there?
I hope not.
I actually think what we're looking at with that is kind of a preview of the next gen Panamera, because that is a four-door model right there, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean,
it just seems like a big leap from Porsche to go that far into, you know, something that's more of a Tesla than anything else. You know, it's again, you know, a company that's renowned for its engineering and its sort of development, right? And they're going after this new niche, and so that's what makes me wonder about it being our analog for the 959, a car that really pushed the envelope, and it was quiet. Like, it didn't make as much of a stir then as it has now. Like, it had a much larger impact on the market than we actually, I think, could appreciate back when we first saw the 959. And I wonder if this is the same thing or if I'm just blowing it out of proportion.
No, coming from that perspective, I think you might, you know, you could be making an argument. Maybe this is the pebble and that's going to radiate ripples through Porsche for the next coming years. That could be. I mean, they've been pretty clear that, you know, hybrids and electric vehicles, they're coming from them. So, you know,
hey, if
they look like this, right. I hope they don't look like this. At least the front end doesn't. But I'm very curious to see what they do.
Hey, you know, if they look and drive like Porsches, it's not going to be all bad. So, all right, what else you got? You got two more.
Let me think real quick. I really like the Mazda Koaru. Is that how we're saying it? Do we have a good pronunciation on that?
I don't think so. It's CX-9.
Koru. Kuru. I don't know.
Kurosawa.
No.
That's not a samurai film. Although it looks like it should be.
It looks like it's got samurai weapons on the front of it, though.
Yeah, that's just a beautiful looking crossover. I really hope that this design just comes directly to the road, as close as they can get it. Mazda, they just make affordable looking cars look, or, you know, they make affordable cars look fantastic. You know, a Mazda isn't really stretching anyone's budget too much, like, you know, a BMW or Porsche or anything like that. But man, do they nail design.
Yeah.
That thing just looks fabulous.
I've really found myself actually preferring Mazda to some of those like German brands that we all are supposed to, you know, really lust for. It's like, yeah, I mean, you could get the 3 Series or you could just get a Mazda and have as much fun for a lot less.
Sure. It's a beauty.
Yeah.
One more. F-Pace, I think, is interesting. You know, it's, again, it's not one that I really find super beautiful. There weren't a lot of cars that I really found drop-dead gorgeous other than the Koaru at this year's show. But just, you know, Jaguar Land Rover coming out with a crossover, that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too. You guys, we were talking a little bit earlier about the show and it being a light show this year. So was there not as much as you were expecting, or, like, were you underwhelmed by Frankfurt at all? Or
I mean, I was a bit underwhelmed.
Yeah, it just seemed there are a lot more concepts than actual production cars.
Okay. I
mean, that's Brandon, do you disagree?
Well, I was going to say, I think we're underwhelmed because we're just awesome at covering these things now, but...
we're modest, too.
No, I was definitely a bit underwhelmed in terms of just the stuff coming out of the show. But, and again, I was talking, you know, Seth and I had lunch today and we were talking about it. And I think part of what makes it seem so underwhelming is that a lot of these vehicles are, you know, because Frankfurt is the first show of the auto show, quote unquote, season. A lot of these vehicles, you know, they've been teased for months and months. And
yeah,
they, sure. You know... Some of them even went back and debuted back in June. So These don't feel like new vehicles to us.
Yeah, even the F Pace, which
The F Pace has been so relentlessly teased.
Yeah,
and you know the same with the god awful Infiniti A Class and you know a bunch of other things. You know, this is really. You know, we have a show like Detroit where everything that shows up surprises us, and this is kind of the polar opposite of that.
All right, so while we've got your attention, then what are your top three from? Not necessarily the top three, but the sort of the three most noteworthy.
I think the F-Pace is
love that.
A very big deal because it's going to do for JLR what the Cayenne did for Porsche, and
you don't think it's going to cannibalize Land Rover?
I don't think so at all. I think the Jaguar and the Land Rover customer are different enough, and I think the character of this vehicle is going to be different enough that they can coexist.
I just hope used ones go for the same prices that used Land Rovers go for, because it gets so affordable.
Yeah, I just I think this car is going to end up being very, very, very popular and bringing a different kind of consumer for Jaguar. And, you know, the thing that people think about is Porsche didn't need any help selling 911s or anything like that. It didn't need help selling cars when it came out with Cayenne. And Jaguar is in the same position right now. JLR can't build vehicles fast enough.
Really? Is that the case? Because, I mean,
they just added capacity in, like, Austria or something like that. So
Was that the deal that they made with Magna? With
Magna,
You know, I think this is the kind of vehicle that for them it's going to push them over the top, and you know you're gonna see a lot of these on the road.
I wish them nothing but the best. I think there's a lot worse I could be looking at on the road. So excellent. What else?
Citroen Cactus M.
You know, Steve's not here. Somebody has to carry the Citroen torch, right?
Yep, that's right. I love the idea of a Cactus convertible. It's really, really cool.
Is that what is that underneath? Is that like a pile of crap underneath, or is it just like just a? Is it based on like another like more plebeian Citroen, which sounds weird? Like,
well, yeah. So it's based. I want to say it's based on the normal C4.
Right. Okay.
But this is, you know, it's super lightweight. I have to
talk about my ignorance of French car platforms, because.
Yeah, I don't know. I went with Steve when we mysteriously got a test drive of one around Detroit, and it's a very endearing car to drive. And aside from, you know. A horrible, horrible, awful transmission, and the fact that it was super slow, the ride was beautiful. The interior was comfortable. It was fuel efficient. It looks outstanding. And this one's a convertible. I mean,
The French.
Yeah, the French. I mean, they do so much wrong, but their car building is just right.
I'm going to leave that one right there and suggest that we talk about another car now.
I'm actually going to talk about yet another car that we're not going to get here, but that I love the idea of, and it is the Seat Leon. Sport Cross or Cross Sport
Cross concept. Sport, I think.
Yeah, this is. It's basically a three-door crossover, which is the coolest kind of crossover.
Therefore the most cool. Yes.
Exactly. It has the engine from a Golf R. Mm-hmm. It's like 296 horsepower, I think. All-wheel drive, obviously. Lifted. and it's bright orange, and it's better looking. It's basically a lifted all-wheel drive, better looking Golf R.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. I'll take it.
Well, no, yeah, the thing is, it's like, it's kind of unassuming. Like, it doesn't have like a.
It is. It's not obnoxious.
Fenders or anything like that. It just kind of.
If they hadn't painted it like retina searing sunset orange, if they had painted it silver, it would have been so hilariously under the radar.
Mm-hmm. But then underneath the hood is this 296 horsepower all wheel drive, you know, hot hatch. It's just like, it's a cue ship and it's fantastic. And good on you for bringing that one up.
I was really geeked when I covered that, because I didn't think I was going to like it. And then I started reading about it. I'm like, this would actually be really awesome. I would like to drive one of these.
Well, you're going to get like all those pieces here.
It's not going to have a Seat badge, but and that's kind of the disappointing thing is because, you know, we get Volkswagens here, but Seats are better looking Volkswagens. They're better looking Volkswagens. Like Skodas are more versatile, robust Volkswagens.
Yeah, Skodas are also very good looking.
I do like a Superb or an Octavia.
And they have cool names like Superb and Octavia.
Yeah. Yeti. Why can't we have a Skoda Yeti in the United States?
You can have a Skoda Yeti. What you have to do is move.
Yeah, I know. Give me a reason.
If they still pay you in dollars, it might not be a bad deal.
Yeah, but then I got to pay taxes there and here. And that's just no.
I mean, what are taxes? But tribute. All right, so I'll go with the Borgward BX7.
Why?
Because it's weird and it's Chinese and it's a return for a brand that's been gone for a long time, really. And I remember being about, oh gosh, I want to say I was like 6 or 7 years old, and for Christmas I got a like an illustrated encyclopedia of automobiles written by Gian Giorgiano, who was apparently an auto journalist back before I was born. But it was really cool. It had all these little, it had color plates up front, so it had, you know, 20 pages of full color photos, and I think a Borgward Isabella or something was one of the cars there, and you know, being a kid in the U.S., like, I had never seen a lot of the stuff that was in here, so it really fascinated me. And so that was one of the brands, like, I learned about it there, and, like, it's just, I don't know, sentimental attachment. It's cool to see the name come back, even if it's, you know, attached to a Chinese knockoff of whatever. You know what? I think it's neat. So there. and the F-Pace is sort of
it's the F-Pace.
Yeah, I know. I want them to correct me one of these days. I will, when the next time I talk to Jaguar, which might be soon, because I think they're bringing the XE to town, I will ask them flat out. I'll say, is it F-Pace or is F-Pace acceptable?
And I'm only calling it the F-Pace. I don't care if they correct me.
I think one of the Native American tribes around here called raccoons Mapache.
The F-Pace?
So you could call it the raccoon. I think like you, that's a very significant vehicle. It's going to do very well for that brand, and it's going to be the shot in the arm that they need, you know, the right product at the right time. I'm actually excited to get one of those as a press car, just because, you know, I've been waiting for it for a long time. I thought, even before there were rumors of it, that a Jaguar crossover, or, you know, Jaguar Cayenne, as it were, is probably a good idea. And so hopefully that's actually borne out by reality. And the third one, I don't know, I'm having a little bit tougher time, because there's like, there were a bunch of concepts that were interesting, like the Mercedes IAA concept was neat, and I don't know, I just, the thing about the European shows is they bring the weird,
like the Thunder Power.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, yes. The Thunder Power looks like a car somebody built in their like spare room or whatever.
It says in the release that was designed by Zagato, which,
okay, yeah, I mean, I guess, was it designed by like the Zagato interns, or? I don't know. It's very soft, and we're not doing soft like that anymore. Like that's a 90s thing. So, yeah, I think the actual, like, the next actual legitimate car that I is probably significant would be the Bentley Bentayga, just because it's making such a stir. Because, again, it's, you know, another product that is sort of in the right segment for the right brand. But, man, is it disgusting.
It's pretty awful.
It's vile. But then again, I mean, you know, Bentley owners aren't exactly, from what I know of them, they're not people that generally would have a great deal of conversation to have with me. So clearly I just don't get it. So let's jump actually into a couple of news and notes things. There was a completely separate, not auto show, not car reveal piece of news that's actually big, but it's been a little quiet just because of what else is going on. But Google actually picked up John Krafcik.
That's a far bigger deal than it's being made right now.
That's like quietly huge. Because he's legitimate. I mean, his pedigree is from automakers, and he studied the Toyota production method, and he was at Ford, and he was at TrueCar. And do you think it's really a sign of, we don't have to spend much time on it, but like, do you think it's really a sign of actual seriousness about their program at Google?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it has to. I mean, to have him running your autonomous car program, that definitely shows that this is a serious deal. I don't know if there's any other way you could take it.
Well, so do you think the end game is still a car, or do you think the end game is actually to use his relationships to position Google as an OEM for manufacturers? Like, hey, we'll build you the technology that you put in your cars. That's to me the most logical play and the least risk for Google. Well, but they're sitting on piles of money, so they can do whatever the hell they want. Killed that one dead. You can now drop $62,000 on a base model Ford F-150 Limited. Is that vile? What's your reaction?
I mean, if people buy it, and they will, because, you know.
Because why? Why would you buy?
Because buying a loaded F-150 is somehow more socially respectable than buying a BMW 5 Series. And I've said this before, like, especially here in America, you look like a douche if you buy a 5 Series, and you don't if you buy an F-150.
I've seen a lot of douches getting out of pickup trucks.
So have I, but... There's still the chance that if you get out of the F-150, you don't look like a douche. With the 5 Series or the E-Class or the A6, you're basically saying it's – the F-150 is basically a much more subtle way of saying I have money.
Mm-hmm. I guess. When they're gussied up like this, they just look
– I think they're a bit garish. I'm not crazy about the looks. But
too much tinsel.
I think the statement you're making by driving a vehicle like that is – far more accepted among the public than if you were, you know, driving a 550i.
That's weird because, like, it's such a useless vehicle. It's an F-150 for $62,000. Like, $62,000 buys you plenty of heavy duty pickup truck that can actually go to work. The F-150 is limited by the fact that it's the F-150. Like, it can't do that much.
But it makes you look modest in a weird sort of way. The fact that you're just quote unquote driving a pickup truck.
Right, there's an expectation if you buy an HD truck that you're actually going to use it properly. I don't think there's any such expectation with the F-150.
All right, I don't get it. I completely don't get it. So we'll just move on, and we'll talk about labor negotiations because that's even more exciting. But again, quietly momentous, the two-tier wage structure. And so the UAW and the automakers they're going into their deal making. And so FCA is the lead automaker that they're negotiating with. And rumor has it that they are putting together a deal that winds down that two-tier wage structure over 4 years. That's a pretty big deal too.
It's a very big deal because this is going to go in and inspire the contract talks with GM and Ford.
Yeah.
This kind of sets the tone.
And so, like, in Europe, when people get moved from, you know, two wage tiers to single wage tiers with the automakers, they generally go to the upper tier. So is that what we're seeing? I mean, I guess we're going to have to wait.
We don't know, but that's kind of what you would expect, but I don't think any of that information has really come out yet, especially since Ford and GM haven't even agreed on to it yet. So
yeah, I would
we're
be
still kind of speculating about what's going on behind closed doors at this point.
I would be shocked if the UAW agreed to any kind of pay cut. But you know, the two sort of march in lockstep, the, you know, labor and the automakers. So it doesn't seem all that contentious. It just seems like they're negotiating at this point. We, again, it's behind closed doors, but yeah, it'll be an interesting couple of weeks to sort of see how that plays out once they come to an agreement with Chrysler, and then how that echoes throughout the other automakers. So we'll have some things to talk about besides auto shows, because Tokyo is coming up too, right?
Yeah, next month. Then SEMA is coming up, and
oh, that's right.
Then LA, then Detroit, then CES, then Chicago, then Geneva, then New York, then China.
And then you get two months off.
Can you tell I look forward to auto show season?
Do you like auto show season?
I love auto show season. It's especially, and Chris will agree with this, we've been so freaking bored this summer.
Yeah. Last month was boring.
So last month. Oh my god, last month was awful. There was just nothing to do.
And yet we showed up and we posted.
Whoop, ding.
Nice. Sorry. The cookies are done.
The cookies are done.
All right, let's do some questions, because we got some questions. With the Nissan Grips claiming inspiration from Rally Z's, do we, what are our thoughts, I guess? I think it's nasty. I think
my original lead for that story, and Steve wouldn't let me use it, was just, God damn it, Nissan.
Well, you know, you don't want to blaspheme on the interwebs. It never goes away. And
yeah, I know. But I think take away everything about, you know, the Z from this, and I think it's a cool little, crossover hatchback. I'm all for it becoming the next Juke. I think it looks, I actually really like the way it looks.
Really?
And I do. I genuinely do. I like Nissan's V-Motion grill.
That tiny greenhouse, though.
I don't know, man.
I mean, it's going to get softened up for production. I like the way it looks. I just don't like the idea of it being a Z. Like, if you want to build a Juke with the soul of a Z, go for it. But you damn well better build a two-seat hardtop / convertible with a V6 engine and, you know, manual transmission, rear-wheel drive, and low to the ground. You better still build a Z.
Well,
you can't lose the plot that severely.
I think this is more a branding issue than a vehicle issue. I don't think Nissan would really make the next Z a crossover. And I think they kind of might have messed up a little bit by even hinting at that with this. But I don't think it's actually going to happen. I think you're right. I think this is kind of a preview for the next Juke. Because as far as I know, that has done gangbusters in Europe. And this, you know, Frankfurt would be the right show to show that off.
That's an interesting little bit of strategy. Yeah. I don't have a problem with them talking about their Z heritage, but yeah, if that is the Z, they're just going to marginalize it.
I highly doubt it. They wouldn't do that. That would be insanity.
they built the Cross Cabriolet. Need we say more? Right? You got nothing.
You're right.
All right. So let's see. We can spend somebody's money. You want to spend somebody's money?
Absolutely.
All right.
Why the hell not?
Justin's looking for a new car for his wife. She's got a G35 that's getting a little old and impractical. They don't want a CUV. They like the Golf Sport Wagon. So would we pick it over a CRV, a RAV4, a CX-5?
I mean, where do they live? I'm trying to find the question right now.
They live...
California.
We get a state?
Yeah.
Oh, hell, look at the Golf. You don't need a crossover. And the Golf is the Golf Sport Wagon. I loved that car when I had it, especially with the TDI. And it's just a very, very good car. And it's a bit pricey, especially if you go with the SEL and, you know, add the options and stuff like that, which you don't really need the options. Like, get the lighting kit, but leave the other stuff. Because the park distance control is just mostly broken. But the TDI with, you know, the sport seats and the manual transmission is a very fun car to drive, and it's very versatile, and it's a diesel, so you're probably going to be saving gas. It'll probably be reliable.
Dude, but isn't diesel, like, ungodly expensive in California?
I don't know. Is it?
I don't know.
I think all gas is ungodly expensive.
www.gasbuddy.com.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just... So the Golf Sport Wagon, yeah, I guess, Chris, it makes a case for itself by being something that is very hard to find otherwise, that sort of small wagon.
But... The lowest price of gas in metropolitan Los Angeles is $243 for diesel and $287 for regular.
Oh, wow.
So almost, you know, quite a bit of money.
That's... Yeah. That's a big
gap.
That's different than here.
it's going to be more similar here. Around town, at least.
Yeah, that's true. It's definitely going to get it'll definitely significantly save there, and it's going to have a lot of torque. That you're not going to get that torque like in a CX-5 or
Especially, you know, depending on what part of California that you live in. If you're in NorCal and you're dealing with a lot of hills and stuff like that, you're going to find the Golf a much more livable everyday car.
You know what? Let's do a little imagination. Let's say that they are hipsters that relocated from Seattle to Hollister.
Well, you buy a Subaru then.
Yeah, no, they had a Subaru. Oh, I guess they had a G35. That's
or you wait 6 months and buy a Golf Sport Wagon all-track.
Yeah.
It's not even going to be six months.
So where did they relocate from? I don't know. They relocated from Texas to Hollister because the store and the made-up stories charmed them, and then they got to Hollister and they found out that it was not what the store says it was, and it's, you know, the site of Rebel Without a Cause or whatever.
Where are we going with this?
I'm just babbling.
I have a question that I would like to address.
Sure.
This is from Henry D. This is from the Michigan Autoblog staff.
Henry? Let's say it's Henri.
Let's call it Henri.
Henri.
I recently moved to Western Michigan, the Holland area, and am curious about the winter. Should I invest in snow tires? I come from northwestern Iowa, where our winters are much colder and a lot windier, but we get very little snow. For the record, I have a front-wheel drive car. First of all, I would like to invite you back the next time Seth Miersma is on, and you can ask him about buying clogs, because you're in Holland. You have to deal with the Dutch. But really? you're over on... Huh?
Really? Is that like okay. Carry on.
Holland is like very Dutch.
Hence the name.
Well, hence the name, but yeah. There's clogs and there's great Cherry Fest and all that stuff. It's a good time. But you're on the west side of the state, so you're gonna learn very soon about something called lake effect snow. And it's going to make your life hell. So you want to have snow tires. You need to have snow tires.
I won't disagree with that, and I'm sure, Chris, you get...
I had a horrible experience last year during the Detroit show. I had all seasons on my Mini, and I didn't realize that Michigan doesn't clear the freeways like Ohio does, and it was just standing snow, and I was praying to God for snow tires. So, yes, if you're living in Michigan, get snow tires.
Yeah, and especially out there, because when you're getting that lake effect snow, I mean, you're going to wake up some mornings and there's going to be 2 feet of snow on the ground, and that's not an exaggeration.
Oh no,
like that's not an exaggeration at all. Yeah. You can get by with a car, but you need to have snow tires. I drove a lowered Mini for 5 years, and I had snow tires. I never got stuck once. So it's all about the rubber, not about the car.
Mm-hmm. And you need a snowblower too, like a nice errand.
Oh yeah, invest in a snowblower.
Yeah,
I will say the nice thing about snow tires are you can buy them once and depending on how much you drive, generally you can at least get two winners out of them. If
I got five seasons out of mine.
Yeah, I was gonna say five is very good. I generally get three or four, so more like four.
But it's a big investment. I mean, when we bought them for my girlfriend's car, like she had 19s on there, it was like $1,200. Oh, but if you have like a reasonable size tire, like a volume size, like a, you know, 17. Something with a 17, it's going to be a very, you know, reasonable investment.
Also, look at your deductible, because I guarantee you that it's probably, you know, relative parity with the set of snow tires. You know, that deductible isn't going to go far when you crack up your car. You're going to be out that cash, and the repair is going to cost more. So now we sound like a bunch of dads, so we should move on. I actually got an email.
Buy snow tires.
Yeah, definitely buy snow tires. And you know, you guys can gut check me here, but I called the Ford Ranger a terrible truck, I guess, a couple of podcasts ago or something. And I still think that it was a terrible truck. And
are we talking new Ranger or like
no?
Ranger? Are we talking when it was new or it by modern standards?
Just by my standards, which are, I guess, you know, sort of modern with a memory. So Isaac writes in, he's like, he's curious why I hate the truck so much. So I read the first sentence of this email, and I was like, of course, he owns a Ranger. And then he goes on to say, if you do not mind, I would like to defend it. I know it's not the most refined, but they're dependable, tough trucks. And he's got a 93 with 280,000 miles on it. And so just generally, he's questioning why I think the Ranger is a terrible truck. And then he goes on to answer the question. One may argue build quality and long-term durability. I was like, exactly my point. Like, the Ranger is a tough truck because it's simple, but it's also just not terribly well built. I don't know.
I will say I've never seen a Ranger that did not have a cracked dash.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, that 80s American car sort of build quality where you've got large panel gaps. And I mean, they're I don't know. Maybe I'm being too hard on the Ranger. Am I being too hard on the Ranger? I mean, it was a product of its time.
I think in its day, it wasn't horrible, but it just, it stayed around, I think, past its welcome, in my opinion. It really needed another refresh there going towards the end. But when you start looking, compared to other compact pickups in 93, I don't know that it was the worst choice.
No, it was good in 90. Like, so that's the thing.
It's just in 2015, yeah. It becomes a bit more iffy.
I think you're right. I think part of what I feel about it is like they just let it die on the vine. And so, like, I remember I was in high school when that last Ranger redesign came out. Okay. I was through college, had spent 5 years as a professional. I was married. I had a house and a kid. And the first auto show I covered for Autoblog, the Ranger was there. Like, it was on the floor. And it was the same Ranger for the most part. So, like,
and if I can play devil's advocate, you're a Volvo guy. How long did the Volvo 240 stay around? Well, that was over a decade.
Yeah, it was. I mean, yes, it was. And the 240 nearly killed Volvo. Like, that was the car that almost put them out of business because it cost them so much to build and it wouldn't stop selling. And they tried to kill it with the 740, and that didn't work. And they, you know, made the 940, and that didn't work. The only way they were able to kill that car really was the 8 Series, which saved Volvo. So, yeah, I you know, it's just two different kind of price points. So, like,
two different price points, but yeah. Just a long lived model doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. But in the Ranger, I kind of think it was. I think it did need another update.
So that's
my opinion.
That explains my distaste for the Ranger. And you know, I mean, I think you can argue like the Tacoma, because I think we were talking about the Tacoma and that's where the Ranger came up. And you know, they're both good sort of compact trucks. The Tacoma has its own issues too, like frames that rust. So, you know, nobody's immune. Right now we the Colorado is the king of the refinement in that segment. So, you know, take my opinions for what they're worth, which is probably nothing. And on that end, I think we should let Brandon go collapse, because he's been up for like a week straight, and it's getting to that time. So this has been podcast 447. So we will be back next week. Thank you, Chris Bruce and Brandon Turkus, for joining me this week.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.